Okay, where are we in this course now? We're trying to understand the Cold War. It's the fourth and, as I said last time, to my mind, the most interesting of the great conflicts of the 20th century, great conflicts among the great powers that we're studying in this course. And and I guess the main point of the last few lectures is that the Cold War is profoundly puzzling. Right. Here you have the continent of Europe divided at the end of World War II. Right? Soviet power dominates the East, American power dominates the West. Doesn't that mean that both sides are pretty much locked into the status quo? Doesn't that mean that both sides pretty much have to accept the division of Europe, accept the fact that the other part of Europe is dominated by the other power? Because the status quo for both sides is vastly preferable to a new war. But if that's the case, if both sides are locked into the status quo, where's the problem? Why should there be tension? Shouldn't there simply be a recognition of the fact of, well, Europe is divided, that's the way things are, our basic interests are preserved, the other side doesn't want a war. We could live with things the way they are. Right? There was, you might say, a fundamental rule that should determine political outcomes in this period. Namely, the Soviets would control things on their side of the line of demarcation in Europe, and America and her friends would call the shots on their side of the line of demarcation in Europe. If everyone accepted that basic rule, there shouldn't be any problem. Now, what this means is that if there was a problem, and we know there was a problem because the tension started in the spring of 1946, and the Cold War continued, one form or another, for nearly half a century. How was it to be understood? How is that? Why should you ever bother? It must have to do with some exception to that fundamental rule about how the two sides could get along. Okay. And what was that exception? Okay. Not Eastern Europe. The Americans were never really challenging Soviet control of Eastern Europe. As for the Soviets, they pretty much accepted that the Western powers would, call the shots in Western Europe, but with one great exception. And what is that exception? West Germany. Right? West Germany. They wanted some say over what happened in West Germany. Why? Because they're aggressive? They want to communize all of Germany? No. It's a security argument. Given what they had suffered at the hands of the Germans, especially in the Second World War, but even in the First World War, the Soviets were bound to be concerned with German power, with what would happen even if West Germany were able to develop as much power as she was in theory capable of generating, if all the controls were removed from Germany. Because West Germany is where Germany's industrial capability, war-making power, is essentially concentrated. And the West Germans, especially if they became strong, would not be willing to simply accept the status quo of a divided Europe, a divided Germany, the way, say, the Western powers were willing to do it. United States, Britain, France, no problem living with a divided Germany. In the case of the British and the French, this is quite explicit. The Americans, a little bit less explicit. But, you know, they're status quo powers. It's not their fellow citizens who were, subjected to this communist rule. But for Germany, a nationalist of the country like Germany, it's a country like Germany with a strong national sense, it's not going to accept the Soviet domination, communist rule over half of its pre-war territory, if it has any ability at all to alter that situation. If you're weak, there's nothing much you can do about it. But if you're strong, then you could speak with a stronger voice. You could make your demands much clearer. You could ultimately threaten military force. You could threaten to intervene in the event of an insurrection in the East, etc., etc. Okay, this was something, and conceivably you could even pull in allies to support your policy, threatening in effect to defect from your alliance with them if they don't support your fundamental national goals. You can do that if you're strong. And so the Soviets have an interest in making sure that that doesn't happen, given that they're in effective control of half of pre-war German territory. Okay. They have an interest in making sure that West Germany does not become too strong. Right? And they're not going to wait until this is, the threat of German military action is imminent. They're going to try and nip this problem in the bud, because it's going to take a long time for this to happen. You're going to move ahead relatively slowly. You know, this whole process whereby German power would recover could take place over years, maybe even over decades. The controls would have to be removed. The Germans would have to begin to acquire more and more in the way of sovereignty, independence, self-determination, control over their own political fate. And then once Germany became totally sovereign, then she would be free to build up her military power. And once she built up her military power, she would be able to pursue a much more forceful foreign policy. You don't want to wait until that happens. You want to nip the problem in the bud and impose limits on German power before the problem became unmanageable. Totally comprehensible policy. Okay? On the other hand, the West has a totally different set of incentives in this regard. The West understood these Soviet concerns and was willing to contemplate a system where there were controls on German power. You see this at Potsdam. The whole hope at Potsdam was that you could settle all these things in a relatively friendly way with the Soviets. This policy remained intact until the end of 1945. It was the policy that Secretary of State Burns pursued at the Moscow Conference in December of 1945. An amicable settlement, right? The division of Europe and, in fact, division of the world, both sides would accept and so on. But by early 1946, it was becoming clear that that policy was not going to work. Well, what made it clear? The crises in the Near East, the Turkish and Iranian crises. Okay, what did these... What did these crises show? The Soviets were back down in the end. They pulled out of Iran. They liquidated the pressure on Turkey. Yeah. But still, the Americans came away from this with some important lessons. Why did the Soviets back down? Because of America's willingness to use force. The only thing they respect is force. You can't reach an amicable understanding with them and then expect them to just comply with that out of the goodness of their hearts. They're Bolsheviks. They respect power. And therefore, You need forces in being. You need to mobilize the power of your own society in order to provide a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. There has to be a counterweight. If there's no counterweight to Soviet power in Europe, there's nothing that would prevent them from penetrating into those areas, ultimately taking over those areas, harnessing the resources of all of Europe to their war machine, and then the threat to American security would be quite serious. This was a view, incidentally, that the Americans had reached before we even entered World War II. I should say, if you're interested in this stuff, there's a remarkable book by a guy named Stoller called Allies and Adversaries. It's about strategic thinking in the United States before Pearl Harbor. And the basic concept, this is the concept that's like behind the thinking embodied in the Victory Program of September 11, 1941. The basic idea was the United States cannot tolerate the emergence of a single hegemonic power that controlled all the resources of Eurasia. We can't tolerate if it's Germany, and already in 1941, we can't tolerate it if it's Russia either. Right. We had hoped to prevent it in a relatively friendly way, but we reached the conclusion now that that's not going to work in the long run. Because this whole understanding that we thought we had reached, that they could keep what they had conquered at the end of the war, but beyond that, nothing. They were testing that. They were pursuing an opportunistic policy of expansion. They obviously didn't want war with the West. But, you know, if there was no real resistance, why not push ahead? And as I say, this led to this dramatic change in the thinking within American policy-making circles in the spring of 1946, the very beginning of 1946. It's these Near Eastern crises that did it. And this changes American policy, in particular toward Germany. There has to be a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. Well, it would be helpful if the Europeans contributed to that counterweight. And militarily, the most important country in Western Europe was now Western Germany. If you got to pull Western Germany into the anti-Soviet side, make it part of this power mass that could balance Soviet power and keep the Soviets at bay. But in order to, and you didn't want to lose the Germans, and there was a real danger that you might lose the Germans if you just ignored them or didn't identify with their national goals. And if you lost them, then the situation in Europe, the problem of creating a stable political system in Europe, it would become unmanageable. So you had this tremendous incentive in 1946 to pursue what came to be called the Western Strategy for Germany. I made a big deal of this. A lot of people think that, the heart of American strategy in the post-World War II period was containment. George Kennan was the architect of the containment policy. So you hear these things all the time. Containment is a reflex. It's obvious. We're there in Western Europe. We acquired that position thanks to an enormous effort we made during the war. We're not just going to pull out and turn it over to the Soviets on a silver platter and allow them to pull together this huge power mass that in the long run might very well be threatening to the United States. We're there. We're going to stay there. You don't need too much in the way of troops in order to deter the Soviets from moving in. A small force would serve a tripwire function, a plate glass function. They move in. As soon as they kill any American soldiers, then it's World War III. So you could kind of deter them with minimal forces. But can you control the Germans with minimal forces? Answer there is, well, not necessarily so. Not if they think that you're stabbing them in the back and that you're not willing to support their national goals. And how do you convince them to side with the West? Because siding with the West, integrating their power into the Western Bloc, this is the argument you make the West Germans, they're worried that if they did pursue a Western strategy, then it would basically be foreclosing any chance of reunification. Because why would the Soviets simply want to turn over East Germany and allow East Germany to be integrated into the Western Bloc? The only chance for reunification was some sort of neutral solution. But the Americans don't think neutralism is viable. Why not, by the way? A neutral Germany is either going to be weak or strong. If it's weak, how can it serve as a counterweight to Soviet power? You know, if it's strong, if it's not subjected to any military controls whatsoever and allowed to build up its power to whatever level it wants, then you're back to where you were before 1939, before 1914. You have this problem of German power and how the Germans are going to use their power. You know, a strong Germany is viewed as a danger. Okay? So the West is basically not going to support German unification. Not only that, but is pushing the Germans to adopt a strategy or to adopt a policy that basically forecloses the possibility of unification. The more Germany aligns itself with the West, the less conceivable it is that the Soviets would ever agree to a reunified Germany. So how do you get the Germans to go along with something that runs counter to their most fundamental national goal? How do you do it? Not an easy problem to solve. See, well, one of the ways you do it is you say, we're not responsible for the division of Germany. We're big supporters of national self-determination, and we believe that the German people, like any other people, has a right to a unified nation state. It's the Soviets that are responsible for the division of your country. You know, this is not an honest line. As you know, this when you look at what American policy was, you could see that this is not an accurate representation of the policy that had been pursued, especially at Potsdam. But they have to say these sorts of things. They have to point the finger at the Soviets as the great saboteurs of German national unity in order to get the Germans to side with us. Not automatic. No one thought the Germans are, you know, great believers in democracy or anything that are going to side with the West, regardless of the policy the West pursued. You know, it's hard to bring them on your side, right? You say you want to pursue this policy, the Western strategy for Germany. Again, let me remind you what it was, because this is what was distinctive about U.S. policy, not containment. Western strategy for Germany. That the western zones of Germany would be organized, first economically, then politically, and ultimately militarily, under the aegis of the three western powers. That they would be tied to the western world in all kinds of ways, economically, politically, and ultimately militarily. That's the strategy you want to pursue. It amounts to telling the West Germans to give up on unification, to not think of themselves as part of Germany, but rather as part of Western Europe. Because a key part of this strategy is what was called the building of Europe, the construction of Europe. This is the whole process that led to the European Union, ultimately, to the Euro, and so on. The whole idea of the building of Europe, which meant in those days not all of Europe, but continental Western Europe. Basically Germany, France, Italy, and the Benelux countries. Right? If you bring a Western Europe of that sort into being, then that would be strong enough to pretty much balance the Soviets on their own. The whole dream of a freestanding Western Europe, this could be a rival to, in fact, a substitute for the dream of German unification. The whole idea of building Europe is like a fundamental goal of American policy. But that policy, by the way, is considered kind of crazy by some international relations theorists like Kenneth Walls, who said, why would the United States want to create this kind of rival power bloc? The U.S. government at the time didn't view it that way. See, American government is not an imperialist, doesn't have these imperial aspirations. We don't want to stay in Europe as an end in itself. We don't want the whole idea of hanging around there just so that we could throw our weight around and be the, you know, this great imperial nation. The goal is, you have to understand, we pay a price during the Cold War for our presence in Europe. This is not something that's an asset to us. In many ways, it's a liability. The fact that we have to protect Europe. Right? We have to protect Europe. That means that our necks are on the chopping block in case of any really serious trouble in Europe once the Soviets acquire the ability to strike at the United States, which everyone kind of knows is going to come sooner or later. Right? We don't want to have to carry that burden if there's any viable alternative. And the alternative that people dream of is the alternative of a freestanding Europe, meaning continental Western Europe. And so the Americans become really fervent supporters of this policy. So much so that one of the Frenchmen who was very much involved in all these things is a guy named Massigli. He wrote a book, and the title in French is called The Comedy of Errors, you know. And it's about the beginnings of European unification. And he has a whole section there. It's entitled The American Origins of the Schuman Plan. The Schuman Plan is a very important step toward the creation of the European community. It was the call in 1950 by the French foreign minister, Schuman, Robert Schuman, to create a coal and steel community in Western Europe. And he says, the American origins of the Schuman Plan, the Americans are pushing for this kind of thing. The French and the Germans, for their own reasons, are also very keen on this sort of structure. Again, all this is under the general aegis of the Western strategy, building Western Europe. Why do the Germans want it? Because countries want some control over their own destiny. For Germany in this period, a purely national and nationalistic policy, out of the question. Too tainted by recent history. It's much more acceptable, both in the eyes of foreign countries and in the eyes of the Germans themselves, for the Germans to present themselves as good Europeans, as standing up for an independent, supranational West European entity. Right? It's much easier to be patriotic about Europe than about Germany for Germans, both for foreign policy and internal reasons during this period. Yes?
So, since Russia there had so many revolutions during that time, was the British, the French, and West Germany not enough to stop the Soviet Union?
In principle, they are enough. If they could come together and pool their policy and pursue a common foreign policy with a unified military establishment, sure, Western Europe is enough to balance Soviet power on their own. But, you know, all those ifs, they're very problematic. You know, if you're French, do you want to basically hand over control of your own national forces to foreigners, basically?
But do you want... The French want to create that, or still have that block, the Western bloc.
They want a Western bloc. The question is, a West European bloc, you mean? Or general Western bloc, including the United States?
Well, they wanted a bloc, a powerful bloc.
Of course they did. They were worried about this Soviet colossus in the East that's emerged as a superpower at the end of the war. And of course the French want a counterweight to Soviet power. The question is, if you're French, do you want that counterweight to Soviet power to be based pretty much exclusively on a U.S. military presence in Europe? Well, you know, how long are the Americans going to stay? How long are the Americans going to be willing to pay that price? And even if the Americans were willing to stay indefinitely, which is by no means clear in the 1940s, Even if they were, don't you, as a European, want some degree of independence, some control over your own national destiny? Or do you want to simply be a satellite of the United States, an American military protectorate? Right. Now, you realize the Europeans don't have a terribly high regard for the United States. And they don't like the idea of being so totally dependent on America. So that means they need to have not just a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe, but also a counterweight to American power within the Western Bloc. And if they're just isolated, small, middle-sized countries compared to America, that's not going to give them too much. But if they kind of come together as a large West European bloc, well, they could stand up to America, and they could pursue policies that the Americans would have to take seriously. Okay?
What? So then why the U.S. was trying to build a stronger Western Europe, so why didn't, and French wanted that, so why didn't they just...
Why didn't it just happen, right? Why didn't it just happen? That's going to be one of our main questions that we're going to be concerned with in this course, especially when I talk about the Eisenhower period. The Americans want it. The Germans want it. They're big believers in a strong Western Europe, creating a West European Federation. The French want it. Why do the French want it? Because they know that the controls on Germany can't last forever. That if you're serious about, pulling West Germany into the Western world, you kind of have to treat them much more like equals. That means you got to respect, respect them as, not totally independent, but. But it's a more sovereign country. You got to take off the controls. But the French are terrified that a full resurgence of German power will lead to great, a new round of instability in Europe. They don't want Germany to become too strong. So the French feeling is, if we're going to get rid of the controls on Germany that were established at the end of the war, the limits on German power, so on. The fact that Germany doesn't even have a government until 1949, West Germany, then we're going to have to replace it with something. You can't replace it with nothing. The thing to replace it with is a European system, so that you would have European controls on German power. They would apply to other countries as well. That meant that Germany would be treated as an equal, and the Germans could accept this, and you could deal with the German problem that way at the same time as you deal with the Soviet problem, right? You have to realize, from the standpoint of a lot of people in the West, there are these two big problems that you got to deal with at the same time, the German problem and the Soviet problem. A lot of people feel like, you can't deal with both of these problems at the same time, because to deal with the Soviet problem, that means to create enough power to balance Soviet power in Europe, you're going to have to unleash the Germans, and that'll just create the German problem, right? As it turned out, events showed that there was a way to deal with both of those problems at the same time, right? Dealing with the German problem was a lot easier when you had this big Soviet army, a threatening Soviet army, right on Germany's border. This made Germany dependent on the West in a way that she hadn't been after 1919. And if Germany is dependent on you, you don't have to worry so much about the sorts of policies they're going to pursue when you take the controls off. It's the Cold War that enabled you to solve the German problem. Because the Soviets were basically doing the job of keeping Germany in line, forcing Germany into dependence on the Western powers, who were status quo powers. Right. Okay. Why is all this stuff of interest? It's because it sets off this kind of spiral dynamic. The Soviets pursue this aggressive policy toward their south, you know, toward Turkey and Iran. The West, especially the United States, react by saying we got to mobilize our own power. And that means kind of pointing the finger at the Soviets, generating enough power in Europe so that there would be a counterweight to the USSR on the continent. And that implied in particular something like the Western strategy for Germany. You got to pull the Germans into that power mass as well. You got to tell the Germans that the Soviets are their enemy, that we support your national goals. You got to, these policies of playing up to the Germans and ultimately going along with policy that would lead to the removal of a lot of the controls on German power, to giving, allowing the Germans to create a government, a state, become more and more sovereign, to develop more and more in the way of military power and so on. This was bound to be viewed by the Soviets as threatening. But if the Soviets viewed it as threatening, the Germans might be a little worried about going down that course, given how vulnerable they were to Soviet military power. And so you had to kind of reassure the Germans, pay them more, basically, in order to side with the West. You know, Europe pulled down the path of the strategy of, you know, removing these constraints on Germany, allowing the Germans to create a state, you know, integrating Germany into the Western Bloc. The more you move in that direction, the more the Soviets are alarmed, the greater the pressure there's going to be, you know, and so on and so on. It's a spiral dynamic. Okay. The spiral theory, spiral model of international politics, this is one of these things that's associated with a certain body of thought in international relations theory, in particular with Robert Jervis's book, Perception and Misperception in International Politics, a great classic. And Jervis was the one, you recall, who kind of developed the whole theory of the security dilemma. That's what you see in action here in the post-World War II period. It's a security dilemma mechanism. Not exactly the way Jervis portrayed it in his classic article on the subject, but the whole idea is countries are led to behave aggressively, if you will, in a way that their rival powers will find unpalatable. For purely defensive reasons. We have to do this stuff in order to kind of keep West Germany on our side and maintain a balance of power in Europe, keep the Soviets from gobbling up all of Western Europe, right? The Soviets, for purely defensive reasons, have to object to what's going on with the Western strategy, to a policy that will lead, maybe ultimately at the end of the road, to the removal of all constraints on German power, to full sovereignty for West Germany. They're bound to object to this for purely defensive reasons. So you can have a conflict resulting from the clash of essentially defensive policies. Very important conclusion. You don't need an aggressor to have a war. It's the security dilemma dynamic here that's responsible for creating these tensions. Okay. This is different from the way that Jervis developed this theory. Well, basically for two reasons. First reason is, in the international relations literature, they view the problem as inherent in the fundamental structure of international politics. This view is somewhat different. It's much more focused on contingent historical events. Like, it took an awful lot in the way of Soviet aggressiveness vis-a-vis Turkey and Iran to get the wheels turning and get this mechanism moving in the first place. And the second thing is that in the Jervis article, he focused on the purely military side, what countries were doing in terms of building up their military forces. But here you can see it's the political side that's fundamental importance. Okay. Now, the measure of the power of this whole way of looking at these things is that people understood that this dynamic was at work in this period, and they tried to resist it. They tried to see if some sort of arrangement could be worked out with the Soviets that would keep these tensions under control, right? And this is basically the heart of the strategy that Secretary of State Marshall pursued when he was appointed to that office at the beginning of 1947. He didn't like the idea of all this tension with Russia. Why? Because he thought it would empower the Germans, as it in fact was bound to do. The Germans were bound to profit from this conflict, the way third powers always profit from conflicts among major powers, just as the United States profited from the conflict between Russia and China in around 1960 and so on. He was worried that this would enable the Germans to play off East against West, gradually recover their power, and we'd be off and running again toward a third German war. Okay? And he made this huge effort in 1947 to try and work things out with the Soviets. You know, spent like 2 months in the spring of 1947 in Moscow dealing with Stalin about this stuff. It just didn't work because there's no really viable solution anymore. And Marshall came back from Moscow, and in his frustration he said, there's no alternative but to move ahead with doing these things in the West. This is the origin of the famous Marshall Plan for the reconstruction, essentially, of Western Europe during this period. And as the Americans kind of gave greater emphasis to the Western strategy, relations with the Soviets naturally deteriorated. This period of late 1947 is known in the literature as the Zhdanovshchina, the Zhdanov period. Zhdanov was one of Stalin's key subordinates, and he took a very tough line in a speech that he gave during this period, just basically treating the conflict between East and West as inevitable and condemning the West in a very unrestrained language. Americans made this one last effort. This is this London conference of December of 1947. You know, it's like this French historian, his name is Cyril Buffet. He has this terrific book dealing with this period, and he calls this the Conference of No Return. They're crossing the Rubicon here. Right? The Conference of No Return. We make this big effort to see if we can work out something with the Soviets about Germany. It becomes quite clear it's not in the cards. This is not just the Americans, but the British and the French as well. As a matter of fact, they're willing to go further than the Americans in terms of breaking with the Soviets. Right? Breaking with the Soviets. We can't work out this German thing together with them. We have no alternative but to move ahead with the Western strategy. And what that means at this point is, you know, we've gone through the economic phase with the buy zone and so on. Now we're moving into the political phase. The process begins for the establishment of a West German state. Not a fully independent state, by the way. And so what you have in the 48-49 period is events moving along these three separate but interrelated tracks. First, the process leading up to the establishment of a West German state. This is the key events here are the what are called the London Recommendations in early June of 1948. And then it's a whole constitutional process that those recommendations provide the framework for, leading finally in May of 1949 to the establishment of the Federal Republic of Germany. Not in a fully independent state, still under military occupation. There's something called the Occupation Statute, which limits the sovereignty of the Federal Republic in major ways. The Soviets react to this by putting pressure on the West at their most vulnerable point. You look at the map, where is their most vulnerable point? It's West Berlin, because the city of Berlin, Greater Berlin, like Germany as a whole, is divided up into four parts. The three western sectors are called West Berlin. There are western military garrisons there. West Berlin is under the military protection of the three Western powers. But to get to West Berlin, they have to go through East German territories, right in the middle of communist East Germany there. Very easy for the Soviets to put pressure on the position of the Western powers there. Their goal is not to kick the Western powers out of Berlin. Incidentally, what's the proof of this? How do we deal with this? Well, we don't have enough force, really, to push our way through. So they opt for this airlift, the famous Berlin airlift. But the Soviets don't interfere with the airlift. As a matter of fact, they cooperate at the Berlin Air Traffic Center, making it possible for these Western planes to fly into Berlin, right? But they don't jam the radars or anything like that, and you kind of need radars to kind of land in Berlin for a lot of the year because of the all the clouds and the overcast there. Yeah.
Why would they assist the airlift?
Because they don't want to kick us out of Berlin. This is just a way of putting pressure on us. It's the italics and the exclamation point in their diplomatic position, which is, you got to talk with us about Germany. You can't just move ahead and solve the German question on your own. There has to be a four-power solution, right? They want the West to take their interests vis-a-vis Germany seriously. That's the point of it. The Berlin blockade is a reaction to the London recommendations. Everyone understands this. The timing itself. Early June, the recommendations. Late June, the Berlin blockade. The timing itself suggests a causal connection. Very clear. Okay. But we're not willing to do that. We had played that game of trying to work out a four-power settlement for Germany from 1945 on. Didn't work. You can't have it in a Cold War environment. And so, but the Soviet moves, basically interfering with what are, you know, core Western rights, implicit in the whole Berlin settlement. This meant that, well, we have to think more seriously in terms of how we're going to fight a war. If push comes to shove and an armed conflict breaks out, we got to worry about whether we can handle this. Okay? And so you have this third track, the security negotiations. Then what will the United States do? If war with the Soviets breaks out, if the Soviets invade Western Europe or whatever, and the answer is, well, we're going to commit ourselves. North Atlantic Treaty. Okay, April 1949. Okay. Yes, American power will be formally engaged with the defense of Western Europe. Okay, now. What does this mean? The basic political realities had been tested by these events. The Berlin blockade runs its course. The crisis kind of fizzles out. The blockade is lifted also in the spring of 1949. Spring of 1949, end of the blockade, establishment of the Federal Republic of Germany, establishment of the NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Right? Well, you may say, all right, well, it's been tested. People had a chance to kind of see what fundamental political realities were. And so now a stable system should come into being, a system based on the formal division of Europe into blocks. Because it's not only the Soviets respond to the establishment of the Federal Republic of Germany by creating their own state in their part of Germany called the German Democratic Republic, right? East Germany. Right? Formal structures are now in place. Eventually, NATO is met by a formal Soviet structure within their sphere called the Warsaw Pact. Formal structures are in place. Doesn't this mean that, well, the system is there for all to see? The Soviets, in abandoning the Berlin blockade, have, in a sense, acquiesced in what the West was doing, setting up a West German state. well, you can only scream for so long. They've accepted things. We should have a stable system. But you don't have a stable system. Instead, the world moves into what was arguably the most serious crisis of the whole Cold War period. This is the crisis of the winter of 1950-51, which in my mind is the risk of war in that period was greater than it was even during the Berlin crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis period of 1961-62. In large part because an air atomic war would have been much more fightable in the early 1950s than later. How is this to be explained? Right? This is the second time we've confronted this problem. First time was with Potsdam. Spheres of influence, peace, amicable divorce. Two sides should have accepted the division of Europe. They don't. Instead, you go into the Cold War in 1946. And here again, a formal division of Europe into these two blocks. You'd think the two sides would have now accepted the status quo. But no, instead you have this great crisis of 1950-51. Very sharp crisis in the Cold War. What went wrong? Why did this thing not work? The answer there is, if the Soviets had decided to lay off Berlin, it was not because they were happy with the political status quo. You did not have a political understanding, a true political meeting of the minds. That took place in 1945. If they had agreed to kind of lay off Berlin, this was simply out of respect for military realities. And what were those military realities? The United States in early 1949 still enjoyed a nuclear monopoly. If a nuclear war broke out, the Soviet Union wouldn't be destroyed at first. We wouldn't be able to do anything more than just bruise them with our small atomic article. These are these early atomic bombs of relatively limited power. It was hard to deliver them. A lot of the bombers could get shot down and so on. But there was no doubt as to how that war would eventually turn out. The Soviet Union would be utterly destroyed. It might take 5-10 years for it to happen. But they would be destroyed in the long run. So they have no, they have no interest in pushing matters to a point where there was a real risk of war. But the Americans didn't want to push matters to where there was a real risk of war either, because we had practically nothing in place in terms of forces and being, aside from the nuclear monopoly. As a matter of fact, we dismantled our entire nuclear machine because we felt we could rely on the nuclear monopoly. You know, this remarkable military establishment that had been built up during World War II, just thrown in the trash heap. And what that meant was, even though we'd win the war in the end, Western Europe would be destroyed in the process. And how could you maintain an alliance? How could you keep the Europeans on your side if you were willing to pursue a policy that would lead, if you miscalculated to their destruction? Yeah?
Had they foreseen fighting in Korea? I know you said that it was a problem around 1950-51 and they disarmed. Did they foresee fighting in Korea as another part of the problem? They didn't want to engage in Europe? Or was that...
At which period are you talking about?
Like, 1951, 1950...
Yeah, well, I'll be talking about that in the next lecture about the whole Korean business and why that was such a severe crisis in 50-51. But just to kind of foreshadow the answer here, the Soviets in 49, or spring of 49. Decided to liquidate the Berlin blockade, right? This did not mean that the Soviets had reconciled themselves to what the West was doing politically in Europe. What held them back was their sense for, you don't want a war with the West at this point. All of those calculations change overnight. On a particular day, August 29th, 1949. August 29th, 1949. What's important about that day? That's the day the Soviets exploded their first nuclear device. That's the day the Soviets broke the American nuclear monopoly. Why is this important? Because if the one thing that's holding the Soviets back and allowing the Americans to basically maintain things as they are, even though we're relatively weak in terms of forces and being, conventional forces and so on. If the nuclear monopoly is the one thing that holds the Soviet back, once you remove that from the equation, once the nuclear monopoly is broken, then there are no longer those constraints on Soviet policy. And given that the fact the Soviets had not accepted the political arrangements that the West was establishing in Western Germany, you can expect a crisis. And in fact, and this kind of gets to your question, American leaders, as soon as they heard about the Soviet atomic bomb, drew these implications very quickly. We're headed for trouble. Spring of 1950. We don't know where it's going to happen. And when the Korean War broke out, it was interpreted in a light. This proves that it's all the stuff in the military sphere that was the only reason the Soviets were holding back. Now we're going to have real trouble with them because they're in a much stronger position. So, did you have a question?
What was that date again?
August 29th, 1949. The breaking of the American nuclear monopoly, Soviet atomic bomb. Okay, so that's where I'll pick up with the lecture next time.